The loneliness of suffering. Some of you have felt it, and others of you have watched it. But no one has described it more beautifully than one who, out of the experience of hospital suffering, penned these words. It's when the lights went out and the room was suddenly plunged into darkness that the awful awareness came. The traffic at the hospital went on like an uncontrolled fever outside the door, but inside that room it became still, so that you could sense the walls and the room itself growing smaller. I was never a lonely person up to then, at least I don't recall being lonely. But now I knew what it was. My family had gone home together to the familiar safe place, but I was here alone, isolated from them, facing the uncertainties of what hospitals mean. Up to this moment, I had joked and laughed with friends and family because it all seemed like kind of a lark. But now I knew. And I suddenly swallowed hard against that pressure in my chest. I was a little girl again, wanting someone to put on a light somewhere to cut the darkness so I could get to sleep. I became terrified by the feeling, and sleep was a long time coming, hours of trying to push my mind off of the emptiness, the fear, the darkness, and now the hospital itself slowly growing quieter, almost eerie, until there was only silence. If you've been there, you know exactly what he was talking about, what she was talking about as she wrote. I wish I could locate Psalm 116 in the life of the psalmist. One of the difficult things as you try to interpret the Psalms quite often is to try to remember or to figure out where David was in his own life when he wrote these words. And I frankly can't tell you where Psalm 116 was penned or where David was in his own life. It's quite possible that it is simply a presentation of David's own spiritual renewal. But if it is, it is couched in the words of physical suffering and hurt and delivery, and provides a wonderful opportunity for us to listen to the poetic mind of the great Old Testament singer as he describes for us the emotion that he felt as he went through the period of suffering and despondency for whatever reason we know not. The first thing we notice as we read the psalm is that David has wonderfully captured the characteristics of sickness. In descriptive terms, he paints for us the picture of what it is like. In key words throughout the psalm, we see it and we hear it and we can almost feel it. First of all, he describes it as discomfort. Isn't it interesting that in the third verse he actually uses the word pain? The pains of hell got hold on me, he writes. And I can't help but remember what C.S. Lewis wrote some years ago when he said that God whispers in our pleasures, he speaks in our conscience, but he shouts in our pain. It is God's megaphone to arouse a deaf world. Think of that. Pain is God's megaphone to arouse a deaf world. And David said that one of the characteristics of sickness is discomfort. It's pain. He goes on in verse 3 to describe it as despair. The sorrows of death compassed me, and the pains of Sheol got hold upon me. I found trouble and sorrow, he wrote. Trouble and sorrow. He says in verse 8 that another characteristic of sickness is a kind of depression. He speaks in the 8th verse of his tears and of his eyes watering in tears. From his feet nigh unto falling. My friend who has written of sickness in the hospital goes on to describe the kind of depression that overtook her as the hospital experience became more vivid in her mind. She said, everything about me was on a chart. I wasn't a name except when they had to remind themselves and check my wristband. All of my body chemistry, its mixtures and everything, was on that chart. They knew what my blood was like, what pills I took and when, what my elimination habits were. They even knew through a monitoring system how I breathed, how my heart reacted to every move. All of what was supposed to be me was on a chart bound in a leather jacket. But no one bothered to know me, really. That I was a gregarious person, a person who liked to laugh or ask what made me cry and what made me happy. Nobody seemed to care whether I liked to go fishing or boating or to baseball games or what kind of food I liked to eat. None of that was relevant. I was not a person, but an object for sticking and probing and testing and experimenting. They stood over me and they hummed or they grunted or they sighed or they whispered in the corner of the room. But seldom did anyone tell me what it was they were whispering about. It was all so very secret, but it all went on that chart. So I was left to my own imagination of what was wrong, how serious, and whether it meant a life of inactivity with my job on the line or becoming a burden to my family. After a while, I sank deeper into the doldrums. I thought I was strong enough to lick anything that happened to me, but lying there day after day with my fears playing havoc with my mind and emotions, I was actually reduced to being a little child. One night, I let the tears come, and that was a shock to me. To realize that I had come to a place of such total helplessness and despair and anxiety that I lost control of myself. End of quote. Depression. Oftentimes it is a part of illness, and especially illness that is serious. David goes on to say that along with the depression, there is a kind of dependence that you don't like. He speaks in verse 8 of his feet being kept from falling. And please notice that it is not something he is doing for himself, but he has become dependent upon someone outside of himself. I don't think there's anything more difficult about the hospital than to recognize that you're no longer in charge of yourself when you get there. I used to live in dread of going to the hospital in Fort Wayne. Almost all of our college and career ministry there was made up of the nurses from the Parkview School of Nursing, all of whom worked at the Parkview Hospital, which was our hospital. And I used to wake up thinking how terrible it would be as the pastor of our church to be so totally dependent upon all of these in that hospital, waited on by people that I knew. And you know, when you go to the hospital, you leave your dignity at home. You don't take it with you. Someone has said that we spend all of our lives learning how to clothe ourselves for the sake of modesty. And as one person put it, trying to find the best fashion to dress up. All of that unravels in the mockery of that horrible contraption called a hospital smock. And someone mentioned to me not long ago that the one thing you can be sure about that thing is that no matter where you sit down, it's cold. There's something very undignified about the way they dress you up when you go to the hospital. And somehow you leave all your dignity behind. You become totally dependent. David goes on to say that being sick is being despondent. Verses 10 and 11, he mentions, I was greatly afflicted. I said in my haste, all men are liars. In other words, he's crying out to God. In some sense, he's looking at the world as if it has played a mad joke on him. And everybody is a liar. Nobody's telling him the truth. I can almost hear him crying out, why has God done this to me? Why am I like this? Would somebody please explain to me why I have to be where I am experiencing what I'm experiencing? And if you've talked to many people who've gone through serious illness, you know as I do that many of them fight in their inner hearts with all kinds of guilt. There's always a preacher somewhere on the radio or television or in some magazine who will come along to help them with that by telling them that they're sick because of sin. I'd like to catch every one of the folks who teach that doctrine by the neck. and in violation of what I preached this morning. Sit them down in the front row and instruct them that there are many reasons for sickness, and only one of them is sin. That God often allows sickness to come into the lives of some of the most godly people who ever walked upon the face of this earth. And to tell them that one of the reasons they may not be sick is perhaps God has not yet come to the place where He can trust them with sickness. Oh, how wonderful and helpful it is to be able to liberate people who are punishing themselves in the midst of sickness, even as I believe David is doing as he cries out against the world that seems to be lying to him, and to tell them that there is no reason for them to feel that emotion. A young girl died in the church I pastored who died of a very serious and strange disease that you probably have heard about out here, called Reye's syndrome. Comes upon children usually after some other illness and catches them with a high fever and ultimately very quickly takes them if they are not treated properly. One of the girls in our congregation, in a family of a mom and dad that I'd had the privilege to lead to Christ, was taken out of this life in just a matter of 24 hours with Reye's syndrome. And oh, how awful and hard it was to deal with that family and minister to them. Someone told me it would be helpful for me to read the book that Joyce Landorf had written called Morning Song. And between the time when that little girl died and when I had her funeral, I had a trip to take where I had to preach, and I stuck the book in my briefcase, and on the plane I read it all the way through. I have to honestly admit I washed the contacts out of my eyes two or three times in that trip. Because it's an honest and forthright book that I think every Christian ought to read. And in her book, Joyce Landorf deals with this whole problem of guilt during times of sickness. And I remember that she found someplace a person who had poetically described this whole process. I'd like to share with you just a few strophes of this particular presentation. It's called Remembered Sin. And this is the way it goes. I made a lash of my remembered sins. I wove it firm and strong with cruel tip. And though my quivering flesh shrank from the scourge, with steady arm I plied the ruthless whip. For surely I, who had betrayed my Lord, must needs endure this sting of memory. But though my stripes grew sore, there came no peace. And so I looked again to Calvary. His tender eyes beneath the crown of thorns met mine. His sweet voice said, "My child, although those oft-remembered sins of thine have been like crimson scarlet, they are now like snow. My bloodshed here has washed them all away, and there remaineth not the least dark spot, nor any memory of them. And so should you remember sins which God forgot?" I stood there trembling, bathed in light, though scarce my tired heart dared to hope. His voice went on, "Look at thy feet, my child." I looked, and lo, the whip of my remembered sins was gone. Oh, if I could say anything to you tonight who may be suffering, who may be sick, who may be sorrowing, I would say that the God we serve is not a God who spends his life in retaliating some past and confessed and remembered no more sin. And if you choose not to forgive yourself for that which God has forgiven you, then you have elevated your standards higher than those of God. I remember one time when a young girl said to me, after she had sinned and had asked God to forgive her, she says, "I know God forgives me, but I can't forgive myself." And I said, Oh, you have higher standards than does the Lord? He can forgive you, but you cannot forgive yourself. And all of a sudden, just like a light went on, she realized that if God has forgiven us, we have been forgiven by the highest court of appeal in the land. There's one last characteristics before of these characteristics before we look at another section of the psalm, and I don't know what to call this except it just seems to be dread. Dread. The sorrows of death, verse 3, describes it. The sorrows of death compassed me. Verse 8, for thou hast delivered my soul from death. And certainly death is in the context, for verse 15 says, precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. The concept of dread here is the sense that there is no hope. Maybe there's no other way. I don't know if you've ever heard a person cry who's deathly ill. I don't know if you ever heard them call out to God, but there's a kind of earnestness and intensity in their prayer that you don't hear oftentimes. Oh God, help me. It seems as if David has captured the characteristics of sickness quite well. But I want you to notice that he doesn't just describe the situation. He also tells us what he did in the midst of it. And I'd like for us to look not now at the characteristic of sickness, but I want us to look now at the cry of sickness. And there are three things that I want you to note in the psalm. The first one is in verse 1 and 2. And I'd like to put this over those two verses. I cried and he heard me. I cried and he heard me. Verse 1, I love the Lord because he hath heard my voice. And verse 2, because he hath inclined his ear unto me. And the picture in the second verse is most illustrative of the phrase in the first verse. He heard me because he inclined his ear to me. And in my mind's eye, though I know that God is a spirit, I see the person of God leaning over the banisters of heaven to hear the cry of his hurting child. And God is listening with that kind of intensity when we cry, and especially when we cry unto him out of our sickness and our sorrow and our suffering. The psalmist says, I cried and he heard me. A little 4-year-old girl got hurt one day, but she didn't cry for hours. In fact, she didn't cry until her mother came home, and then she burst into sobs. And some of the maids who were watching her didn't understand what was going on, and they said to her, why did you not cry before? And she answered, I didn't cry before because there was nobody to cry to. And we understand that, don't we? And I want to tell you something. If you're a Christian, there's always somebody to cry to. Notice secondly, I cried and he heard me. And verse 7 says, I cried and he helped me. Return unto thy rest, O my soul, for the Lord hath dealt bountifully with thee. In other words, God not only heard me, but he helped me. He dealt with me and he did it bountifully, above and beyond all that I could think. He gave me what I needed, though it may not have been what I asked for. He dealt with me bountifully. I cried and he heard me, but I cried and he helped me. And then notice verse 8, I cried and he healed me. For thou hast delivered my soul from death, mine eyes from tears, and my feet from falling. And verse 16 adds, thou hast loosed my bonds. I was attending a summer conference a couple of years ago where the speaker was Anthony Campolo. Anthony Campolo is a teacher in a Baptist seminary back on the East Coast, and he's a sociologist along with being a preacher. He was talking about the problems that we face today with much of the modern healing movement. And I was agreeing with him in my own heart when he was saying that so often people have been hurt, desperately hurt, because somebody has told them that it is God's will for everybody to be healed. And certainly anyone who reads the New Testament would know better than that. How many times did our Lord walk into a situation where there were all manner of people who were hurting and sick unto death, and He chose one out of the midst and healed them while He left the rest in their condition? Once in a while someone has said to me, "Oh, wouldn't it have been wonderful to have been Lazarus and have been resurrected from the grave?" But you know, Lazarus didn't have it so great. He had to die twice. Do you know that? Anthony Campola went on to say that though it is not true to say that it is God's will to heal everybody, it is true to say that everybody will ultimately be healed. Some will be healed here, and some will be healed there. There's coming a day, my friend, when the Lord is going to come, or we're going to go to be with Him, and the Scripture says we shall see Him, and when we see Him, we shall be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is, and all of the disease of our body will melt away, and we'll be whole like Him. If we aren't healed here, we'll be healed there. And it was with that confidence, and in that confidence, that David exalts the Lord. Is that not one of the reasons why verse 15 is in the text? Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of His saints. Precious. It ushers them in to absolute wholeness of body and spirit. Well, David goes on now at the end of this Psalm, and he has told us about the characteristics of sickness, and he's told us about his own response to that as he cried unto the Lord and He heard him, and he cried unto the Lord and He helped him, and he cried unto the Lord and He healed him. But now David asks a good question. In verse 12, he poses this question: what shall I render unto the Lord for all of His benefits toward me? What can I learn out of this experience? What should my response be to this that I've endured and gone through? That's a good question, one that we don't often ask. Sometimes we are so obsessed with getting well, we forget that God is trying to teach us something, and we don't ask the right questions. David asked the right question: what should I render unto the Lord for His benefits to me? But David, don't you understand that God doesn't need anything from you? Psalm 50:12, if I were hungry, I would not tell thee, for the world is mine and the fullness thereof. What can you give God? David came up with four things in the text that are introduced by the little phrase, "I will." Notice them as we study them together. First of all, I will remember my promise to Him. Verses 14 and 18. I will pay my vows unto the Lord now in the presence of all of His people. I will pay my vows unto the Lord now in the presence of all of His people. Verse 18. David said, what will I give to God? What I will give to God is the promise of my heart. I will pay my vows. I wish I had a dollar for every vow that has been made over the years in a sick bed in a hospital where some Christian has said, oh God, if You'll raise me up off of this bed, I will. And then when health comes, the promise they made in the shadow, they forget in the sunlight. I remember reading some time ago about the night after a scheduled attack. In the military, many soldiers wrote letters to their parents. The chaplain who was responsible to censor the mail was unable to read them until after the battle had taken place. And when he did, he found that two were in the same handwriting. One letter had been written before and one after the brief but intense engagement. In the first, the young soldier was writing to his mother. I vow to God, he wrote, that if I come through tomorrow, I'm going to be a better man. And the second letter was written after the danger was over and addressed to a friend in another regiment. Quote, I've just come through a scorcher up front. If you can get leave and meet me in Paris, boy, will we go out on the town. The vow that had been made in the face of danger had been quickly forgotten. David said, what will I render unto the Lord? This is what I shall render. I will pay my vows unto the Lord. I will remember my promises to God. Number two, I will render my love to him. It's interesting how love is woven throughout this passage on sickness. Verse 1, I love him. Verse 2, I will call upon him as long as I live. Verse 9, I will walk before the Lord in the land of the living. Verse 16, I am truly thy servant, O Lord. I preached this message tonight in the other church, and when I finished, I don't even know this fella. Some of you might know him. He came to the front. He had a cane, and he said, Pastor, 4 months, 4 long months like this. But he said, I want to tell you something. I've never known the love of God like I've known it in the last 4 months. Oh, how he loves me. That's what David's talking about. And then thirdly, verse 17, he said, I will return my thanks to him. I will offer to thee the sacrifice of thanksgiving. I will call upon the name of the Lord. Hard to be thankful in the midst of suffering and sorrow and sickness, but David said, this is what I shall do. I shall be thankful. A brave little girl was taken to the doctor for a minor but painful operation, and when all was ready, the kindly doctor said to her, this will hurt, but you have my permission to cry or to scream as loudly as you wish. And the little girl looked up at him smiling, and she said, if it's all right with you, I'd rather sing. Which she did, as loud as she could with her sweet childish voice, but she went through her brief ordeal without a sigh, groan, or tear. I will give thanks unto thee. And then lastly, he says, I will receive his great salvation. Verse 13, I will take the cup of salvation and call upon the name of the Lord. Would it be a bad thing if God allowed someone to be physically ill and jeopardized their temporal life so that in the jeopardy of their temporal life, he could get them to accept eternal life? You say, well, I don't think that's a very good thing to have to judge. And probably from the perspective we have now in temporal life, that's true. But ask me that question 1,000 years from now. And let me answer it then. In our city in the Midwest, I sometimes feel sensitive to be referencing that city and what I know there, but it's the only experience and past I have, and so I have to use it. There was a young lady by the name of Susan Leonard Johnson who attended our church on occasion and was a very close friend of a number of the gals who attended our church. She was in a Bible study with them. In 1977, she found that she had terminal cancer. Just before we left, a few months before we left the church, she died. And one of her friends brought me a piece of poetry that she had written about her experience. I never read anything like it in my life. I want to share it with you in conclusion. It illustrates better than anything I've ever seen that which we think is a negative factor in our life, suffering and sorrow and sickness, and we dread it and we keep our hands out to push it away from us, though it isn't fun and though it isn't what we look forward to and though it isn't something we ask for, oftentimes it is something God does for us instead of to us. And she describes her journey with the Lord and the place that pain and sorrow and suffering had in her experience. When I was just a child of 5 and learned about my Lord, I never shouted, prove it, and I never felt ignored. My hands were always folded in innocent belief. It was easy to be humble, him above and me beneath. There was no cause to question or to complicate this view. And I'd often hear him whisper, "Oh, my child, I love you too." When I was 1 and 20 and learned about my world, how wise I'd grown, I'd outgrown God. My future was unfurled. "Lord, you know me well, so I won't pray, and I don't need you anyway." How soon? I'm 1 and 30. Why is life such a bore? I'm falling short in everything, and everything's a chore. I have so much, I've done so much, this emptiness is wrong. "There is no God," my logic cries. I knew it all along. "Lord, I doubt and cannot pray one whit. I will not be a hypocrite." Now I'm 4 and 30, and the void is magnified. I do not understand at all how desperately I've tried. Disease has made its debut, and I scream that it's unfair. I'm only given one more year, and I sink in sheer despair. My girls are small, and I'm so young. They say there is no hope. The fear is all-consuming. Please, someone, help me cope. Lord, could that be you that knocks again? Forgive me, Lord. Oh, please come in. Gathering up the burdens, he said this about my strife: "You've been dead for over 30 years, and now I'll show you life." Today, I'm 5 and 30. What a blessed year it's been. The fear was changed to utter peace. There's happiness again. What time unfolds, I do not know, but that's not my concern. Once again, by grace, I humbly trust a precious lesson learned. Lord, I give my all myself to you. Oh, my child, I love you too.